House Committee on Business and Labor to order and apologize to everyone for my tardiness. First thing I'm going to do is open a work session on the introduction of legislative concepts. Teresa?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have eight concepts in front of you today for consideration. LC 1850 relating to code compliance. LC 1851 relating to licensing qualifications for electricians. LC 1852 relating to small-scale local energy projects. LC 1853 relating to bidding requirements for public improvement contracts. LC 1854 relating to the Construction Contractors Board. LC 2655 relating to retainage in connection with public improvement contracts. LC 2693 relating to interstate bridges. And last but not least, LC 3541 relating to supplemental insurance plans.
I would entertain a motion on these.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I move that the committee accept LCs 1850, 1851, 1852, 1853, 1854, 2655, 2693, and 3541.
All right.
As committee bills.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Barton moves legislative concepts 1850, 1851, 1852, 1853, 1854, 2655, 2693, and 3541. Be introduced as committee bills. Once again, members, we are not obligated to vote one way or the other. We're just making a bill. Is there any opposition? Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Representative, we're moving some legislative
Yeah, that's
concepts.
Fine.
Thank you very much. See, no opposition, so I'll move. And I'm going to go right down the line, Teresa.
Yes.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2203.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2203 is from the Employment Department. It ascertains that in a case of conflict between provisions of Oregon Employment Department law and another provision of state law, the Employment Department law prevails, which is ORS Chapter 657. The bill also clarifies the types of employment that will end an individual's disqualification from unemployment insurance benefits. You have in front of you a -1 amendment from the Employment Department, which further clarifies that the ORS Chapter 657 does prevail when a conflict arises between state law and Employment Department law.
Thank you, Teresa. I see the department. Would you please come up and just briefly refresh our memory and answer any possible questions to this bill and the amendment that goes with it?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rob Edwards, tax manager for unemployment insurance tax for the Employment Department. As you may recall, House Bill 2203 clarifies a point of law for us. In some past sessions, there have been laws pertaining to, for example, charter schools. We said charter schools are exempt from all state laws except, and then a short list of exceptions. Unfortunately, unemployment tax or unemployment insurance was not included in that list of exceptions, which caused us some problems due to federal conformity. What we were trying to accomplish with this particular bill is to make sure that if there's a change to unemployment insurance tax law, it is deliberate and not inadvertent. There were some question from Department of Consumer and Business Services about the wording, so we have submitted an amendment that we believe will take care of their concern.
And we're not going to overrule the entire statute. It's just within the confines of this area of law, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Any questions of these gentlemen? Thank you very much. I would entertain a motion for the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll move -1 amendments for House Bill 2203.
Representative Cameron owns moves the -1 amendments into the bill. Are there any questions or comments? Is there any opposition to the motion? All right. Very good. So move. Representative?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2203 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2203 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation. Representative Thatcher, we're moving House Bill. Are you okay?
Yep.
All right. Is there any discussion or questions? Is there any opposition to the motion? All right. So moved. Do we want this, members, do we want this on the floor debate, or does this merit consent calendar?
Put on the consent calendar, Mr. Chair.
Is that a motion, Representative? Representative Polvey moves we put House Bill 2203 as amended onto the consent calendar. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so move. Close the work session on House Bill 2203. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2611.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2611 increases the preceding year production limit for a Oregon Liquor Control Commission brewery public house licensee selling at wholesale from 1,000 barrels to 5,000 barrels. There is an emergency clause in the measure effective upon passage, and there is no revenue or fiscal impact
on
the measure.
Any piece of legislation that even hints at more beer, I cannot see.
Mr. Weed, your name's at the top of this bill. I can't understand that.
Rep, please forgive me for my flippancy. Mr. Marcy and Mr. Welch, please. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. Jim Marquis today representing Pelican Pub and Brewery, and I have with me Darren Welch, our head brewer from Pelican. Pelican's located down in Pacific City, for those of you who don't know. They make some great beer. This bill is a fairly simple and straightforward bill, and we're not going to take a lot of your time this morning. It amends 471-200. The current law allows a brew pub to self-distribute beer if their total production for the previous year did not exceed 1,000 barrels of malt beverage. We have a lot of the brew pubs that are over that in production now and are prohibited from self-distributing anything. We embarked on this little adventure last year and met with OLCC and the beer and wine distributors and everybody else that might have any interest at all in this issue. The 5,000 barrels that is the current proposed change in the law contained in this bill is a carefully constructed compromise between all the parties, and I think I can safely say today that there is no one, at least that we know of, that is opposed to this. Paul Romaine has authorized me to tell you that the beer and wine distributors are fine. I think you have a memo from the OLCC that they're fine, and the residents of Oregon are fine. I think everybody is just okey-doke with this. So with that, I'll turn this over to Darren. We have some owners here who, out of deference for the time constraints, they won't be testifying, but I think Darren would like to introduce them.
That'd be great.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Darren Welch. I'm the head brewer and one of the partners in the Pelican Pub and Brewery. Thank you for letting me speak today. We have in attendance today Jamie Floyd from Ninkasi Brewery, my partner Jeff Shons, also from the Pelican Pub and Brewery, Art Lawrence with the Raccoon Lodge, Steve Moore with Philadelphia's, and Juanita Kirkham right behind me here with Wakanda Brewing down in Florence.
Careless.
And as well.
And I, before you move on, I just want to welcome you to your capital and thank you for understanding. We want to just move along as efficiently as we can, and I just want to thank you for the great service you provide this great state.
I do have a few brief comments before I finish up here. I started over 20 years ago as an enthusiastic home brewer with dreams of one day owning and running a brewery. I pursued my passion for brewing for many years as a home brewer, actually through college and my first career before I joined the ranks of professional brewers. Moving back home to Oregon to open the Pelican Pub and Brewery in 1996 was really only the first of many lucky opportunities in my career so far. The current law limits brew pubs to self-distribute their beer only up to a production level of 1,000 barrels. This effectively punishes brew pubs for growth by forcing their entry into the three-tier system while their brands are still very small, low-volume niche brands. At 1,000 barrels a year, the amount of beer a brew pub can sell to a wholesaler is so small as to not have the opportunity to garner any real attention from that wholesaler. Current law is essentially stacked in favor of the wholesaler and forces brewers of brew pubs to work within a system that really does not function well for brew pubs. Brew pubs, as inherently smaller operations, do not enjoy the economies of scale that larger breweries possess. Another relevant factor is location. Brew pubs are typically located in high-value retail properties with accordingly higher rent or lease payments. Production breweries, of course, are typically in commercial or light industrial districts. These are some of the issues that make the current three-tier system impractical for small-volume brew pubs. In order to be profitable distributing beer, brew pubs have to be able to do it themselves and keep the margin that would otherwise go to the wholesaler. Because brew pubs are forced into the constraints of the current system, with the emphasis on price necessary for the three-tier system to work, this functions as a barrier to consumer quality and solution. Many brew pubs actually stop growing in order to retain the margin that they need on their beer in order to survive, i.e., they stop growing so that they can retain the right to self-distribute. Others worry about the neglect their products might receive as part of a large distributing operation and how this can negatively affect quality. In the last year, we have seen major consolidations in the beer wholesale sector as large companies have merged to form even larger companies. This consolidation limits access to market for the smallest players. Brew pubs need the right to get out and build their own brands. House Bill 2611 will affect meaningful change for brew pub breweries. It will promote growth and jobs creation. With brew pubs given the chance to do it themselves, artificial limitations to growth will be removed. Brew pubs can control the destiny of their own brands, provide individualized customer service, constantly be vigilant for beer quality, rotate out old products, and otherwise build their brands from the ground up. As our brands grow, we will add brewery staff, drivers, sales staff in order to continue our growth. By setting the new limit to 5,000 barrels, House Bill 2611 will provide brewpub owners with enough ceiling so that adequate business planning can be made to ensure long-term success and prudent investment. I urge you to support House Bill 2611. Thank you very much.
Thank you. In all seriousness, this is one of the bright spots of our economy. You're talking about growth here, and we're going to allow you to grow more. And thank God for that. And I don't know how many thousands of jobs, but Oregon is in this area. People talk about Oregon being the leader. Sometimes I think they're leading us over the cliff in some issues. In this area, we are the leader, and it's because of that. The people that are willing to go out there and work their backsides off and take advantage of being the opportunity of business in America. And I tell you, I cannot thank you, all of you, enough for what you're doing out here. Lord knows I enjoy your product, but sensible people like my wife enjoy your product as well. So it isn't just me. So I just want to, once again, thank you. And I'm not going to do anything in this building to put any kind of damper on your ability to continue to grow in this state. And I just wanted to share that with you.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Kanemer, then Representative Bart.
Mr. Chairman, I see that you are the chief sponsor of the bill. Is there any truth to the rumor that the other sponsor is the Revenue Committee?
Well, if they aren't, they should be ready. Representative Barton, then Representative Wade.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to echo your comments. And despite what the Chair said, actually, he drinks Bud. I don't think he appreciates the craft brew industry as much as he claims. But no, actually, as long as you guys are here, I would love to say, Mr. Welch.
Yesterday the speaker and today the chair, I tell you.
Mr. Welch, I'm actually, I think...
Wait a minute, I need to interject for my freshman friend here. One thing he needs to really get drilled home is the chair always gets the last word.
I'm a huge fan of the Oregon craft brew industry, and indeed I'm delighted that a representative from Fearless is here, which makes the best Scottish ale you ever have, and put Estacada on the beer that made Estacada famous. And in addition, Mr. Welch, you make the best IPA perhaps I've ever had. I hate to say that knowing that someone from Nicosia is here. Apologies. But really, I've done some homebrewing myself. It's actually really hard to do well, and you guys really make some of the best beer in the whole world.
Thank you.
Is that illegal for you to have homebrewed?
Because I'm not 21.
For the record, he is 21. More than 21.
Representative Witt, then Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to suggest that we take a field trip, but I understand we're under constraints here. But short of that, I heard in testimony that there's a problem, perhaps, with rotating out old inventory, and was just wondering if there are local establishments that sell a Pelican so that we could assist in that rotation.
We have no distribution in the Salem area. This is probably an area that we'll be looking very hard at if and when this bill becomes law.
Good. Thank you. Good. I look forward to helping you in your effort. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to recognize Jamie Floyd from Ninkasi Brewery here from my hometown, and I would take exception to Representative Barton's comments about the best IPAs. So just thought I'd throw that in. Just appreciate this industry. They do a great job, and I do enjoy the craft brewing in this state. It's really outstanding.
Well, in politics, all babies are beautiful and all beer is good.
You can pass that on.
All right. Okay. Here we are. I appreciate it there, not taking up too much of our time, and we're rambling on. Any other questions, comments to the language in the bill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, maybe you're going to call me out of order, but I think this would be a good time if Darren could educate me a little bit. I'm trying to get a handle around the barrels versus kegs, and how much goes into a barrel versus what the actual yield is out of a barrel of beer that actually somebody might consume into a glass.
So
can you talk about that a little bit? I know this sure. didn't apply. Well, it does apply in the fact that we're going to increase production and it's going to affect yields.
So the U.S. beer barrel measures 31 gallons. So that's at the, for a brew pub, that's taxable at the point of production. So one of the unique things about a brew pub as opposed to a production brewery is we will actually serve fresh beer directly from brewery holding tanks. So in order for us to not skate by on part of our taxable production, we actually pay on the full volume of beer that goes into those tanks. And all downstream losses, whether they're at the tap or in packaging or what have you, various spillages, that's all tax-paid beer. Now, having said that, if you didn't spill a single drop, each standard-sized keg is a half barrel, so that's 15.5 gallons, and there's 1,984 fluid ounces, which, again, if you don't spill a single drop, will yield you 124 pints of beer, which is the standard service measure on draft. We package our beer in cases of 12, 22-ounce bottles, and with our packaging operation, we get approximately 13.5 cases per barrel of beer because we experience about 10% loss in the bottling process from foam over and spillage and whatnot.
Hmm. Interesting. I have more.
Does that answer your question?
It does. What other, if I may, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Because this will be important in other issues that we talk
about.
We're
not going to hear those issues today.
No, but we'll.
But you're right.
Go ahead.
We'll need to understand them.
I couldn't agree more. Can you talk about other ways, okay, if you're not bottling beer, for example, in several microbrews you go into, and there's walk-ins with long lines of beer taps and stuff. How, on a daily basis, how much beer is poured down the drain in those particular situations for cleaning those taps or weekly or whatever the process is?
It would depend exactly how long the beer lines and how many are in any given establishment. I think a fairly standard loss due to spillage and foam at the tap, exclusive of losses from cleaning lines, I think a 12% is probably pretty accurate. If a bar were operating with, say, 9 or 10% loss at the taps, that would be doing pretty well. If some things go out of adjustment, it would not be hard to contemplate 15 or 17% loss due to foaming issues.
Thank you. And on that, the bill changes one number and has a take effect date. If anybody has any questions on that language, I'm going to accept it. If not, we're moving this bill right now. Any questions on the language in this bill?
Thank you.
Thank you for your responses, and I appreciate your questions.
Yes, thank you.
I do.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Our brewers have agreed, for the sake of time, to keep their peace, and I think Mr. Welch did a great job. Does anyone else want to testify on this bill? Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the works of the public hearing on House Bill 2611. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2611.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2611 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2611 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Barton, would you like to carry this bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd be honored to carry this
bill. Thank you very much, and I look forward to that day.
We're going to have product distributed to...
Mr. Chair, it won't take 9.5 minutes this time.
Thank you, Representative. You'll probably have more than 50 votes. All righty then. Forgive me. I would like to open a... I'm going to close work session on House Bill 2611. I'm open a public hearing on House Bill 2593.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2593 requires the Public Employees Retirement Board to allow retired members and beneficiaries to make voluntary monthly contributions to labor organizations. The bill also requires that the cost for administering the measure's provisions be paid from contributions made by the retirees and beneficiaries.
Thank you, Teresa. And I would like to call Susan Riswick. Excuse me. Oh, forgive me. I'd like to first call Mr. Art Towers. And what's that?
Val
Jack? Is it Val or Valerie? Is Art outside? Okay, thank you. Come on up, folks. And then after that, after this panel, it'll be Susan Riswick and Dave Tyler. Good morning. Go ahead, ma'am.
Good morning. My name is Val Jack, and I'm president of AFT Oregon Retirees and secretary of the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans. I retired after about 32 years with Portland Public Schools. I was a secretary. The last six years, I was president of my union. After I retired, I organized AFT Oregon Retirees, which is a statewide chapter for AFT members who retire in Oregon. So why organize retirees? We don't bargain contracts for them or anything, but I valued my union membership while I was working for the information that I received, for the friendships that I built. I trusted them. A union retiree does the same thing. A union retiree organization does the same thing for union retirees. We send a bi-monthly newsletter to our members with information of interest on things like the digital TV change, PERS information, all the changes we've had over the past few years, the Oregon Prescription Drug Plan, Social Security and Medicare benefits, plus benefits that members are eligible to receive through their union affiliation. Many retirees assume those go away once they retire. That's not true. It takes money to put out a newsletter, and most of our money comes from members' monthly dues. But of about 1,000 AFT members who are eligible to retire, or to be members, only a fraction are actually members. So why aren't they members? Some of them, of course, don't want to have anything to do with their union. They didn't want their union when they were working. But many others, it's a process. Our union dues, while we were working, went to our union through payroll deduction. We never had to write a check, didn't have to think about it. We often contributed to other causes like the United Way through the same payroll deduction. Didn't have to think about it, didn't have to write a check. Now we're retired, the only way to pay dues is to write a check. And the memory starts going first, so we got to remember to write it and then remember to mail it. But the other issue is many retirees have to really watch their pennies, particularly classified employees, which the bulk of AFT Oregon members are working in school districts, don't earn a whole lot of money in the first place. They don't work what we would consider, what I would consider a full-time job. They worked 190 days. They work 6 and 7 hours, so their salary wasn't too great. Their PERS benefit is even lower. So for $2 a month is doable. $24 at one hit, which is what our dues amount to, is a lot for many of our retirees. With the passage of House Bill 2593, a retiree could indicate to PERS the amount they wanted contributed to their union. They could cancel any time they wanted. The cost would be paid by our contribution, so no cost would be incurred to PERS or to taxpayers. Monthly contributions already go out of my PERS benefit to cover my PERS medical insurance. I ask them to do it, they do it. So I encourage your support of House Bill 2593 on behalf of AFT retirees and other PERS beneficiaries. Thank you for consideration of the bill.
Thank you.
Art. And my name for the record is Arthur Towers, the political director for SEIU Local 503. And I'm pinch hitting this morning for the president of our retirees unit, John Hawkins, who's home ill today. But we just wanted to also register our support for the legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And before I open it up, we have, I don't know if you folks have seen this from the department, but it's an estimate of how much this would cost. And I would like you, after their testimony, to go out in the hall and talk about how you can get this down. I think your idea has some merit, but you know, even probably better than I do, the situation we're in, and anything that costs money is definitely probably not going to happen. But I don't mean to suggest you don't have merit in what you want to do. So talk to these folks afterwards, see if you can get that number down, and then we'll see what we can do. I just don't want you leaving here without me sharing that with you. Any questions to these? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your indulgence, I'd like to welcome Val Jack to the Capitol here and to our committee. And recognize her many years of service, not only to the labor movement, but to her community. She is a long-standing and well-recognized community activist, and just a wonderful person. I'm proud to say that she's one of my constituents, too.
Well, very good.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this open up the door for people to, as well, make contributions to charitable organizations if you're retired?
I don't know why it wouldn't. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, we are concerned about the capacity to contribute to lifelong union members to continue contributing to their union, as opposed to the issue of charitable contributions in this case.
Is that a yes?
Well, I'm...
I think it was a no.
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, we're happy with however y'all want the bill to be written on that point. I guess is what I'm saying, not for or opposed to the idea of the charitable contribution.
I think the department may be able to maybe answer more. I mean, it's whatever we write into it where they can give their money to, I reckon. Any representative, are you?
Yes.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
I really do
thank
appreciate you. It. All righty then. I'd like to call Susan Riswick and Dave Tyler, please. And if you have an answer to Representative Esquivel's question, we'd appreciate it too.
All right.
Excuse me. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Susan Riswick. I'm with PERS. I have with me here today Dave Tyler. He's administrator of our Financial Services Division. And we both want to thank you for the opportunity to come and talk with you a little bit about House Bill 2593. What we want to do today is share with you some factual information and also share with you a program that we already have in place right now that we believe achieves better results. You've already heard a little bit about what House Bill 2593 means. So to put it, to summarize it, it means that PERS will need to allow retired members or beneficiaries of retired members to make voluntary monthly contributions to any labor organization, regardless of size, location, or affiliation to that organization, through a monthly deduction of their monthly benefit. We believe that this is going to be an expense to the member, as they noted in the prior testimony, that all the expenses associated with administering this program fall squarely on the shoulders of the retirees. So now I want to talk to you a little bit about the program that we have in place today. What's happening? This year, PERS partnered with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, to implement a similar program. Through that program, voluntary dues are deducted monthly from their benefits of those individuals that wish to participate. The difference between this bill and what we have in place already is AFSCME is responsible for all the administrative activities and all the costs associated with that in implementing that program. They provide us with the information necessary that we need in order to make that happen. As a result, the ongoing costs of this program are considerably less than those as proposed in House Bill 2593. So with that said, I'm going to let Dave Tyler talk to you a little bit more specifically about that particular program and this legislation and what it means to us.
And if, before you move on, if my memory serves me, I think I was on the committee that this committee passed that bill out last session, or I don't remember, but I do remember that concept. Go ahead, sir.
In the past, we passed
that. Yeah, our foggy past. Because we've been drinking too much microbrews.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Dave Tyler, PERS. To respond to your comments, sir, I don't believe there was a bill introduced in last session, but the bill did not pass.
Did not pass.
Oh, forgive
okay.
me.
And I believe it had come up in the previous session as well.
All right.
We have been working with AFSCME to try to structure a program that is both cost-effective and will have minimal impact on our system implementation effort, because we are right in the middle of converting from a legacy retirement system to a new retirement management system. The program we have structured essentially places the administrative burden for communications and contact with AFSCME members on AFSCME. And what they send to PERS on a monthly basis, and this month is our pilot month, excuse me, for this program, they send us one list of members, union members who are interested in this program. We input a minimal amount of data into our system, and the deduction takes place. We don't have ongoing communications with those members other than through AFSCME when they send us a list to say add this person or take this person off the list. Our communication mechanism is on our website. We have a posting on the retiree page saying AFSCME retiree group information, click here, and through our month or our quarterly newsletter to retirees' perspectives. Minimal cost for everyone involved. We are doing that program at the present time with AFSCME for less than $40 a month. It has not taken major system modifications because the entire administrative workload is placed on the union itself. We think this is a better way to go. Our concern is the ongoing communication requirements that the bill would impose upon the agency, annual updates, considerable amount potentially of data input, and as Susan indicated, no standards in terms of how many organizations potentially we would be dealing with and how many members of those organizations we might be faced with either. No minimums at all. We have not had any contact with the sponsor of this bill. We would be pleased to sit down with them and see if we couldn't explain our program and whether this would meet their needs. But at this point in time, this is fairly expensive legislation, and we're concerned about the impact it would have on our ongoing system project.
And you're doing that now with AFSCME, without a bill,
mm-hmm.
just working together. That's even better. I got to tell you, and God bless the good people back there, Ms. Jack especially. So that's what I encourage you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what I would also do, and I'm not trying to make work for you, is notify all the public employee unions about this concept and just see if they're interested, because that way not everybody's going to come up every session with another bill. They can, and I know they will. I have lots of good concepts that we'll look at, but I don't want to discourage anyone from doing that, but any questions of these good people? And once again, please, I said earlier, and now I'm really encouraging you all to step out in the hall and make an appointment and get together and figure this out, because I do believe it has merit. I'm glad to hear it's working out,
No, that's all right, but thank you. If necessary, I assure you, I know where to find you. Okay, any more questions of these good people? I guess, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Would anyone else like to testify to this bill today? They're welcome to if they'd like to. All right, seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2593, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2634.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2634 authorizes the State Accident Insurance Fund Corporation, or otherwise known as SAFE, to accept a letter of credit or similar instrument to secure payment of premiums. There is no fiscal or revenue impact on the bill.
Thank you. Let me see here. Mr. Davey, please. We have everything.
Yes.
Whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Chris Davey with SAFE Corporation. House Bill 2634 is a straightforward bill that adds half a dozen words to the statute that would enable SAFE to accept a letter of credit. And let me give you a little brief background about how workers' compensation premiums are paid. Unlike most other lines of insurance, or commercial or personal lines of insurance, premiums are generally paid in arrears. And so that means that the insurance company is essentially extending credit to the policyholder. We want to be able to hold some kind of security to guarantee payment, and that obviously depends on our history with that policyholder and the size of the risk. SAFE is still governed by some statutes that were written many years ago. This particular statute was written in 1933, and it's only had minor amendments since then. It says that SAFE can hold a deposit, which would be a cash deposit that we would hold, or that we can accept a bond in lieu of the cash deposit. We recently had a conversation with the Department of Justice and said, is a letter of credit encompassed in those words in the statute? And they said, well, no, it's not. The only way that you can legally accept a letter of credit is by changing the statute, which is why we're here today. Letters of credit first appeared in Oregon statutes in 1961. This statute was written in 1933, so there wasn't any way that it could have been contemplated at the time that it was first written. Our customers often would like to offer us a letter of credit, but by law we're not able to accept that, even though they're widely used in all other aspects of insurance and private insurance companies routinely accept them. So we would like to add this to give our customers some additional flexibility and make it easier for them to do business. Obviously, we've reviewed this with the Department of Justice. We've also reviewed it with the Insurance Division and the Workers' Compensation Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with the largest private insurance company, Liberty Northwest, and none of those people have any objection to this bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I just want to thank you for doing all that homework before we brought this up here. Any questions, Mr. Davey? Because we have the impact statements here. There is no revenue or fiscal. I plan to work on it right now. All right, well, seeing none, thank you very much. Would anyone else like to testify on this issue today? All right, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2634, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2634. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we move House Bill 2634 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
And Esquivel moves House Bill 2634 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
I also make a motion that go on the consent calendar.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2634 to the consent calendar. Representative Kenneman.
You know, this is a customer service issue, and I just wonder, you know, it makes it very perfunctory to just have it briefly met.
Representative
Cameron,
would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
Seeing Representative Martin's outstanding example, yes.
So moved. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2634. Is there anything good for the good of the order this morning? Thank you very much.